Welcome to Warships Pod, and this episode's guest is Roger Morehouse, a specialist in modern German and Polish history, especially on the Third Reich and World War II. Roger is the author of several acclaimed books, including Killing Hitler and First to Fight, and now Wolfpack, an excellent single-volume deep dive into the submarine arm of the Kriegsmarine, Hitler's Navy, during World War II, and which was reviewed in Warships IFR magazine in its recent November edition. Welcome, Roger.
Hello, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. Before we submerge ourselves in your latest work, can you explain your path to tackling the exploits of the undersea warriors of the Third Reich and give us an idea maybe of why you've done that and not least a family connection that's mentioned in your book?
Yes, as you mentioned in the introduction there, I mean, my sort of origins, or as a historian at least, lie elsewhere, very much sort of Central Europe, particularly Nazi Germany, but mainly sort of Poland and points east. So I've done military before. I hadn't done naval history before. So this was a bit of a departure for me. But, you know, as they say, we should as historians, we should be able to turn our analytical skills to almost any sphere, right? That's the theory anyway. And for me, I mean, arriving at this as a subject, I started looking around. I mean, I suspect, like you, I'm of a generation, you know, I can remember Das Boot from the first time round, you know, when it was first shown, long stuck in my mind from then. And when I was casting around for another book idea after the previous one, then I started thinking about the U-boat arm and the U-boat war, because, you know, it's such a great subject. It occurred to me pretty swiftly after you know, at least half alighting on that as an idea, it occurred to me that the gap in our knowledge and in the narrative is on the German side of things. You know, the German accounts that get used in the sort of standard Battle of the Atlantic narratives and so on, it tend to be the same ones. It tends to be Dönitz's memoirs. It might be Peter Kramer, you know, the usual sort of things. I just thought, well, there's a story there, you know, just to sort of flip the conventional narrative. And, you know, conventionally, that narrative is very much from the surface. You know, it's from the merchantmen and the destroyers. So I thought I just wanted to flip it and try and tell the story of the Battle of the Atlantic and of the wider U-boat war from the perspective of the Germans, from the perspective of those crews in the U-boats, and see if that, you know, gives us some different perspectives, different questions and different answers. And that essentially was the root of the book. And then the personal aspect that you mention, I'd actually started, I was probably about 6 months in, doing a lot of reading, and had a rather routine Sunday lunch with my in-laws. My mother-in-law's German, for my sins, of course. They were having idle conversation about what I was working on. And I said, I was starting this project. And she said, one of my uncles was in the U-boat arm. And I fell off my chair and thought, well, why have I never heard this before? Probed a bit further. And it transpired he was one of those that had survived the war, you know, one of the few that survived the war, one in four that survived. And spent the rest of his life basically in a succession of psychiatric institutions. And what she remembered as a child growing up was that he used to periodically escape from said institutions, and arrive, you know, at the family home at in the middle of the night, and have to, you know, they had to call the police and have him taken away again. So, I mean, it was necessarily fragmentary story, but nonetheless, I thought it really confirmed my assumption from the outset that there was something here, that there was, you know, a side of the narrative here to be told, which hadn't really been told before.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned the, shall we say, the contrast maybe between Dönitz's standard source and his book, which always strikes me as being his way of, a bit like Churchill with his memoirs, fixing the story of the Battle of the Atlantic from his point of view. And then you get your relative there, who basically was lucky to survive, as you say, and also was driven around the bend. So, did you find when you were investigating the reality of the war under the sea with these young men, some of them a little bit older than their 20s, or some of them, I suppose, were even teenagers amongst the ordinary sailors. Did you find that they kept going through love of Germany, through, was it some of it Nazi ideology, or were they just kind of caught up in the maelstrom of war? What did you find out?
The short answer, I suppose, is all of the above. I think one of the things that I'm sure you will appreciate, you know, from your own work and so on, but any military historian would say that majority of fighting men don't necessarily fight for the big ideals that they're told to fight for. You know, it might be in the back of their mind that they're fighting for freedom and democracy, or for, you know, the greater Germany, or whatever it might be. But I think for most of them, it's about their mates. It's about the most immediate, you know, requirements of survival, and it's about, you know, the guy next to you in the foxhole, or your crewmates, whether, you know, in a U-boat or elsewhere. So I think that's an assumption, I suppose, as a military historian. I don't really call myself a military historian, I must say, but those that do, I think they would agree with that's one of the basic aspects of military history, is that for all the sort of grand phrases and grand ideas, actually, you know, most military men fight for much more mundane sort of quotidian things, like the guy next to you. Beyond that, yeah, I mean, go back to the premise of your question, a bit of everything. I mean, you've got in those accounts that I uncovered, and there's a lot of diaries, there's a lot of you know, archival accounts and German accounts, sort of published and unpublished. It, to some extent, it's a self-selecting group, of course. The material gets left behind. I mean, obviously, they have to have survived, most of them. And then they have to feel comfortable, you know, setting down their memoirs. So I suppose even if they were fervent Nazis, then they're probably going to be a bit wary of reticent about exposing that too much. But in general, I mean, they tend to come across, with all of those caveats in place, they just tend to come across very much as ordinary men, you know, doing their best in very difficult circumstances. You know, the outside world, you know, of necessity in a U-boat, probably more so than elsewhere, doesn't really seem to intrude very much. And that goes as much for the ideology as everything else. There are, of course, a couple of examples that I mentioned in the book of dyed-in-the-wool Nazis who really cause particular difficulties in a couple of vessels, you know, not least sort of denouncing their commanders and that sort of thing. So there's a few examples of that come to the fore, of course. But in the most part, you know, from everything I've read, it's you know, cross-section of society, but you know, very, very ordinary men doing extraordinary things.
That mention you made earlier of, I'll probably mispronounce it here, Das Boot or Das Boot, whatever you want to call it. I well remember, the five-hour version of that was broadcast on the TV, I think 1984, which was a fantastic introduction to that world entirely for me. And I think that in a way that the Dönitz memoirs were an attempt to set the higher level perspective on the Battle of the Atlantic. There was, I think, an effect achieved by the German television series, as it was before it became a movie, compressed of Das Boot, which really set the image of the U-boat crew and the kind of people that were the ratings, the engineer, you know, the captain, the Nazi. I think he was the XO, the first lieutenant. And so it kind of, in a way, gave birth in the later years. And for us, it's, you know, the later years is anything after the 1980s, of the quality and character of the U-boat captains, in that, you know, some of them could be cool and wearing their leather jackets, wearing lumberjack shirts, and, you know, a bit laid back and cynical about the Nazis. So there's a whole culture out there now. And I actually divide the portrayal in that movie from maybe some of the books that have been written elsewhere about the U-boat captains, and the whole thing on the internet that conveys this this image of the grey wolves. So how much did the captains of the U-boats, how much did they live up to the feared Grey Walls image or the Martinet or the cool guy? I mean, did you find that the captains were radically different in their way of waging war and how they treated their crews? Was that something that you noticed?
That's a very good question, Ian. I mean, the very short answer is sort of all of the above. I mean, there are various examples of real martinets, very kind of punctilious, harsh, absolutely by the book, all those sort of characters all the way through. And of course, you've got a massive shift, as you bear in mind, you've got a massive turnover, very rapid turnover, actually, of U-boat commanders all the way through the war. You go through, as a couple of historians that have looked at this would say, you go through about four generations of U-boat commanders during World War II. But certainly in the first period, that first generation, so people like Günter Prien and Otto Kretschmer and so on, you know, there was an element there which does sort of conform to a large extent to that myth, if you like, that sort of suit, that stereotype. Because Dönitz kind of liked, as we know, Dönitz is, of course, a convinced Nazi and all of that, and a dyed-in-the-wool naval man. But he did have a soft spot for sort of maverick types. And actually, people like Otto Kretschmer, Joachim Schepke, they were people who had been in the Kriegsmarine. And there are other examples of people who had, a little bit rubbed the Kriegsmarine up the wrong way. And because there's a degree of individualism in them. And I think that's something that Dönitz quite enjoyed. He liked sort of, finding those mavericks, people with a bit of character about them. So I think that opening, that first generation does conform probably a bit more closely maybe than the others to that sort of stereotype of being, a little bit different, having a bit more character about you. And then later on, as the war goes on, the second generation is the senior officers that had served beneath those guys, and so on and so forth. By the time you get to the fourth generation, you're down very often to, they're pulling desk officers from elsewhere within the Kriegsmarine and giving them rudimentary training and sending them out in a U-boat. So, there's a, huge turnover, obviously, of commanders and crew. And the quality, deteriorates as a result as you go through the war. So, many fewer aces, and even those that even score any successes in the second half of the war compared to the first. But that image, I think, is quite durable, and I can quite see why. But then again, there are later commanders who are quite officious, and as you say, martinets. So it's sort of all human life is there to a large extent.
I suppose it was a case of U-boat arm to begin with was fairly small at the beginning of World War II, two dozen active boats out there in 1939, and then as it wore on, as you say, the first generation, the old gang, the people you mentioned and others were killed basically, and then their juniors came up. So Dönitz wanted to have many more U-boats, but as it went on, I suppose that he found that he couldn't get the quality of either captains or submariners, ordinary submariners ratings, as we would say in the Royal Navy, to actually take them to sea and be effective. Do you think that the bigger it got, the more ineffective the U-boat arm was because it was diluted?
Yes, I would say that certainly diluted. You've got that first generation had pre-war experience. They very often, someone like Günter Prien had experience of being in the merchant marine, for example, back in the late 1920s, early 30s. So had a huge amount of experience that he brought with him into the U-boat arm, and you can see how the next generation and the generation after that, both of crews and commanders, couldn't possibly have the same degree of experience because they're being turned over, as I'm putting it gently, but as you say, killed at such a rate that they've got to be replaced by very often relatively raw conscripts and those with much less experience. So I think that it's quite natural that you would see a deterioration in the quality and the ability to in a sense endure the sort of countermeasures of the Allies, which at the same time are ramping up and becoming much, much more effective. So, this is where I think changing that perspective can be quite useful, because I think conventionally there's an understanding that the Allied countermeasures do get up to speed, certainly by sort of late 41, 42 and beyond, increasing use of Enigma intelligence or Ultra intelligence, development of really effective countermeasures, not least, effective convoy measures themselves, but beyond that, aerial radar, closing the Atlantic gap, all of those factors that we know about in terms of, perfecting that Allied suite of countermeasures. And one aspect that I think traditionally doesn't really get talked about is, looking at it from German perspective, is that deterioration of the crews themselves. And it's a crucial part of that puzzle.
So looking at the picture from a higher perspective, and maybe drawing on your insights, which you have into the Germans, the Nazi regime, that whole era, why, having failed in World War One with U-boats, did the Germans then place so much store by another go at primarily beating Britain, but the Allies, of course, via U-boats again? I mean, did they just have no choice whatsoever, having not managed to build up a big enough navy before the beginning of the war? No carriers, not many capital ships, but U-boats became the thing out of the necessity because other gambits didn't work. I mean, what is it in the psyche of German leadership or the Germans in general, do you think, that persuaded them that they could have another go U-boat assault?
Well, I think two things spring to mind there. The first one is there's particularly Dönitz, and he drives a lot of this along, particularly the early phase. He'd seen at first hand, of course, he'd been a U-boat commander in the First World War. He'd seen at first hand that tremendous effort in the last 2 years of the war of unrestricted, U-boat warfare, submarine warfare, which it certainly hadn't brought Britain to its knees, which is what it was intended to do. But I think it had been pretty effective at the time. Not least as a sort of a terror weapon, but certainly in large numbers sunk at the time. So I think that it was reasonably successful in that sense. So you can see that maybe with the technological advances, with coordination by radio, for example, I think the sentiment was, particularly with people like Dönitz, that in the interwar period that with some tweaks this could be made to work more effectively than it had in the First World War. And in a sense, that was Germany's shot at actually trying to isolate Britain, in a strategic sense. If you can isolate Britain effectively, then you can knock it out of the war. So in that sense, it makes sense, right? But then the other side of this is that I don't think Dönitz did enough to convince the higher-ups, certainly in the opening phase of the war, opening 2 years of the war, of his case. And that's primarily the reason for that sort of lag in the fact that he goes to war in 1939 with comparatively few U-boats, as you said. I mean, something like, I think it's about 29 is the figure I give, 29 combat U-boats in 1939. He has failed really to make his case as effectively as he would have wanted to with the higher ups in that sort of battle for resources and everything else. And Hitler only really comes round to the strategic potential of the U-boat, arguably in 1941, by which stage it's too late. So, yeah, I think it was, in a sense, it was the only card that they really had to play at the time, strategically speaking. And I would argue that Dönitz actually fails to make the case effectively enough in the opening phase of the war.
Dönitz is dominating our conversation here, but I suppose that's inevitable. But you made reference to his experiences in the First World War, where I think he cottoned on when he was in the prisoner of war camp in Britain that one of the problems was that communication, tactics and communication were the core problem. So he comes up with the idea of attacking on the surface, a bit like motor torpedo boats, preferably at night, and then has this idea of controlling everything like, the conductor of an orchestra. From ashore via radio, which, communications became more sophisticated too. So that enabled him to try and assemble the wolf packs, which is your book is all about, of course, and unleash them. But do you think that this was actually the way in for the Allies because of the amount of signals traffic that was going between Dönitz and his successor once he moved up to command the Kriegsmarine. Trying to control the wolf packs was actually their Achilles heel as well, and that's what let the Allies in to, in some ways, destroy them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, very, very good question. And you know, you hit the nail on the head to a large extent, that it is that signals traffic, of course, that gives the, you know, the Allies their way in, you know, via Enigma intelligence and so on. I think it's also more than that, particularly in the countermeasures. I think that sort of overemphasis on Enigma, I think, is a little bit misplaced. Of course, it's an important part of the puzzle, but you know, and as we know, I mean, initially in a sort of defensive capacity, that you can actually route convoys away from the wolf packs, and then later offensively, you can actually start to target them much more effectively. And again, it's using that traffic and predictions, crucially, of where they're going to be. But there's, you know, a lot of other elements to that Allied narrative of success, you know, not least things like the, you know, the Western Approaches tactical unit and what they're doing in terms of looking at Wolfpack methods and you know, how best they could be, first of all, combated, and then also how the Wolfpacks themselves can be most effectively counterattacked by escorts and so on, by sort of wargaming them. And then the technological, I still am of the opinion that aerial radar is actually the, you know, the sort of, I think, single most effective aspect of the suite of Allied countermeasures, because that, you know, it's actually aerial attack that is the game changer in the U-boat war. You know, more U-boats are lost to aerial attack than any other method, because of its speed, because of, you know, the way that with radar, radar equipped aircraft can effectively see a U-boat surfaced, and of course they are most of the time they're surfaced from, you know, something like 15 to 20 miles out, depending on the equipment. And they can be on top of them, and the U-boat has, you know, effectively a minute in which to deal with the threat once it realizes that it's under attack, and takes them 30 seconds to dive, of course. So the leeway that they have is minuscule at that point. So that's why they're so effective. Of course, you can point to Enigma intelligence and say that's how they're sort of locked onto, that's how they know that they're there in the first place. Up to a point, yes, but it's also regular air patrolling anyway. So actually, I think if you had to pick one in that sort of classic way that we have, you know, the standard A-level question, which factor was the most dominant one, I would point to aerial radar myself rather than Enigma. But you're absolutely right. You know, it's certainly that traffic, and that comes back to Dönitz's desire to sort of control things from Lorient. To a large extent gives the Allies their in, and it gives them their sort of foot in the door of knowing where the U-boats are.
Yeah, I mean, as a navalist and somebody from representing a naval magazine, I'd never agree about anything to do with the RAF. So and their aerial radar, because the Navy would continue complaining that the RAF should stop trying to hit the U-boats in the Bay of Biscay on the way back or whatever, and should instead, you know, get them out when they were about to try and attack the convoy, i.e. before it attacked the convoy, not after. Anyway, that's something that we're religiously obliged to point out on this podcast.
Apologies for my heretical opinions.
Yes, for your heretical opinions about the Air Force. But you're right, you know, the VLRs, the Liberators, you know, an amazing aircraft that did incredible things. And then, you know, the RAS effort in the Bay of Biscay, et cetera, was pivotal. But as were many other things, you know, as you said, it was a team thing, vast in its effort. The thing that I was also interested in talking to you about, and I know it's slightly on the British side, but when Winston Churchill said that the only thing that ever really frightened him was the U-boat peril, I mean, do you think he was guilty of hyperbole, or do you think, you know, he actually was more scared by the U-boats than anything else, when he's, you know, an amazing orator and also an amazing propagandist for his own cause and the nation's, and somebody who knew how to shape a narrative for a war while it was unfolding. So do you think he was really that scared by the wolf packs, by the U-boats?
I think it's one of those quotes that has a little bit, like you said, with Dönitz, that in a sense it's sort of written the history and it provides the, you know, the tram lines along which, you know, subsequent generations of historians run. And I think it's a bit the same with that quote. If you look back at the quote where it's written in his post-war memoirs, he's referring to, at the time when that quote is in the text, he's referring to the winter of 40 to 41, which was a particular low point in Britain's fortunes. Of course, the Americans are not yet in the war. The Grand Alliance has not yet been formed. So, you know, the Soviets not yet been attacked. And incidentally, I think this comes from Churchill's memoir as well. He says that the imports into the country in January of 1941 were precisely half what they had been in January 1940. So from that perspective, you can see how both Churchill and, you know, senior commanders in the country were extremely concerned about where everything was going. And essentially the narrative from that point of that winter of 40 to 41 was, you know, if this carries on, you know, this is, of course, coincides with what the Germans call the happy time, when you've got all of those tremendously experienced commanders that we mentioned earlier on, sinking really big figures in the Atlantic and elsewhere, and you know, seemingly doing so with relative impunity because Allied countermeasures are not yet really up to speed. From that perspective of that winter, you can see how Churchill would be right to be alarmed at the prospect. If this carries on, we are going to be in trouble. What's interesting, of course, is that we now know that within a year, you would have the formation of the Grand Alliance. You would have the two industrial superpowers of the US and the USSR on your side, effectively, and particularly the US. It's worth bearing in mind that, you know, the Liberty ships alone produced by the US during World War II effectively replace the, you know, those merchantmen that are lost in the U-boat war. It's about 3,000 in both categories. So, you know, that category alone offsets the losses of the cargo losses of the U-boat war, or the merchantman losses. So, you know, once, you know, within a year, essentially the strategic vision, the strategic game has changed radically. And what I think, so I think we have to understand where that quote comes from and what it refers to. And in that sense, I don't think it is necessarily hyperbole. So I think it's the generation of historians and commentators since that are guilty of the hyperbole and guilty of essentially running with that one line. And Churchill was very good at dropping a decent soundbite, as we well know. But running with that line and essentially extrapolating that moment of fear over that winter and extrapolating it to cover the entire U-boat war. And that's something that I sort of tilt against, because it's very obvious from 43 onwards that, you know, the U-boat war shifts radically against Germany. And certainly from 43 onwards, arguably before, the odds are so stacked against the Germans that it becomes effectively a turkey shoot, you know, and it's the numbers being lost in the second half of the war are astonishing. And to go back to that Churchill quote, the idea that that was still a sort of frightening prospect for Britain is frankly laughable at that point. And again, a look at the stats, which I do in the book, if you look at the stats, 92% of all cargo coming into Britain throughout the war, not even in the second half of the war, but throughout the war, arrives unscathed. So again, once you look at the realities of this, in terms of the size of the, you know, the particularly the British merchant fleet, but then also the Allied merchant fleets, particularly again with the advent of the Americans and everything that they can construct in very short order, it's pretty obvious that that threat was for most of that period was theoretical at best, and you know, really not what it's since been built up to be.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that talking of latter day impressions, which and I must say, Roger, you say you're not a naval historian, but you're doing a very good job here of being a convincing naval historian, because your observations are very very insightful, and I think you've got the facts at your fingertips there, which is very impressive, I must say.
Thank you, Ian.
I might as well say that now and get you buttered up on air before I go into the next question. but I was going to say that the thing which, the other thing, apart from Churchill's quote, is the idea that the Battle of the Atlantic was over in 1943. And what you've just said is correct about the balance, but the reality was, of course, that it wasn't over, and it was just a temporary withdrawal from the Atlantic while they geared themselves up for total underwater warfare, which was one of those things which people will be quite excited by. But, I mean, you know, if we could just chat for a bit about that. The Germans were determined to come back with new torpedoes, the Schnorkel, and new types of submarines. And there was great fear, I believe, on the Allied side, that, you know, it wasn't over, was it? The Battle of the Atlantic was not over in May 1943.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is a temporary withdrawal. Dönitz makes the case. I mean, he effectively goes toe-to-toe with the Allies in that winter of 42-43 and into the spring of 43, and is scoring some pretty big numbers, but he's also incurring pretty big losses as well. So it's really like two heavyweights going toe-to-toe. To carry on that rather... stretch that analogy to breaking point, you could say that, you know, one of those heavyweights corner was much more effective than the other one, so that the Allies could, you know, replace their losses, as I said, mentioning about Liberty ships and so on, which were very much on stream by that point, could replace their losses much more effectively, much more swiftly than the Germans could. So I think what Dönitz does is to withdraw his wolf packs. And as you say, the message where he gives that instruction says that we will be back once we have mastered this sort of technological shortcomings, and that means that shift, as you say, to a much more technologically advanced type of U-boat. So talking about, you know, it's got various irons in the fire at that point, the so-called Walter boats, which are under development, never actually come to anything, but it leads ultimately to the Type 21s, which again never actually see combat, but nonetheless is a game changer. There's other sort of technological developments that are significant. You mentioned the Schnorkel, absolutely enables those sort of what are essentially surface vessels. They're submersibles rather than submarines to run submerged for the majority of the time. You know, if you can do that with a Schnorkel, it means you're not effectively invisible to that Allied radar. You can operate much more effectively. Things like Albrecht, which people don't tend to talk about much. These sort of anechoic rubber tiles that they started retrofitting on U-boats from in 44 and beyond, which are remarkably effective. Actually, they don't really sort of. It's a bit late in the day for them to make a huge difference.
This is for sonar too. Yes, for sonar to soak up or not reflect so much.
Exactly. So it's essentially an anti-sonar measure. And it worked, you know, it worked very well, but too late in the day to really make a difference. So the war goes on in that sense of technological cat and mouse, you know, which is really, I think, is really interesting, an interesting part of the narrative. But also it spreads geographically. So he might withdraw the wolf packs from the Atlantic, but you end up with the monsoon boats going to the Indian Ocean. Obviously, after 41 and the invasion of the Soviet Union, the war spreads to the Arctic. Of course, you've got the Arctic campaign. U-boats are involved up there, and even into the Black Sea. Bizarrely, I mean, this again is a rather ridiculous chapter of the whole narrative, where they had to disassemble U-boats and send them down the Danube on barges, and then have them reassembled off the Romanian coast to operate in the Black Sea. So, you know, the idea that the spring of 1943 is a sort of an end point in the U-boat story is a nonsense, really. It's certainly a waypoint in the story, but it's not the end of it by any means. If anything, it means, you know, the war under the sea kind of, you know, dissipates and it becomes much more diffuse and spreads to many, many more areas of the globe. And the German forces do exactly what Dönitz is trying to do. They try to modernize, they try to get more technologically advanced so that they can come back and they can come back better. Thank God, as we would all say, thank God that they didn't succeed in that, but that was the intention.
Yeah. And do you think that, bearing in mind your other work, you know, you're somebody who knows quite a lot about the doings of the Nazis in other areas, and actually the whole Third Reich thing, if I can call it that. Do you think you can, when you're looking at the U-boat crews and the horrors they went through and the conditions they endured and the sheer casualties, approximately 30,000, 40,000 killed. Do you think, can we find people, whether they're captains, sailors, that we can, even though their cause was wrong, that we can admire, openly admire? Do you think, and I'm not necessarily talking about the ratings here, the ones we talked about earlier that would find themselves involved in this fighting for their fellow submariners, but you know, just in a way, coming back to the whole grey walls myth. I mean, can we openly admire and like, you know, Kretschmer and somebody like Lemp, the guy that sank the Athenia, who we haven't talked about yet, is a guy I find very, very interesting as a character. So can we find people there that we openly admire, do you think, as U-boat captains?
Well, I think admire is a very big word, Bahiri, and even 80 years on, I would draw the line at admiring them. I think we can empathize at least on a human level as to, you know, what they went through and what they were obliged to endure to be at that point in the Atlantic where they're engaging an Allied convoy. That I think we can empathize with that. I suppose what I was trying to do with the book really is not about trying to evoke sympathy, really, or even empathy. Although I think that comes across, and that's the word I would use, some degree of human empathy. If you look at the conditions that they lived and worked in, they are absolutely horrific. I know war's not no picnic for anybody, but for submariners generally, it's particularly grim. And I think for U-boatmen as well, I think it's particularly grim. I think the Type 7 was a fairly primitive vessel. You know, just bearing in mind that the analogous American submarines in the Pacific, you know, had air conditioning, for God's sake. The poor Germans had nothing of the sort. So whether it was freezing cold in the Arctic or, you know, 50 degrees in the tropics, you know, you just had to suck it up.
The British were the same, though. I mean, they also
of course,
had,
yes, absolutely.
No air conditioning. But the Yanks did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wouldn't say admire. I think that's the wrong sentiment to try and evoke, but certainly a degree of human empathy to at least sort of, you know, wince and go, oh Christ, that was pretty grim. And at the same time, you know, the main reason really for the book is to give a degree of completeness to the narrative, because I think the German side of things has been really left out, and you can understand why. It's, you know, that it's the language barrier, sources barrier, and so on. And I think for most people that have written on this, you know, the Allied story looms very large, and unless you sort of consistently and consciously try to concentrate on the German side of things, which I did. I mean, very often while you're writing and researching, you know, be talking about a particular engagement, and the materials that you're using, of course, there's a lot of the you know, sort of standard stuff on the Battle of the Atlantic that I might be looking at. And I did have to constantly remind myself that that's not the perspective I wanted. I wanted the other one. So it's almost like a constant corrective to say, what did it look like from their view? And where are the accounts that tell us this particular engagement from the other side, right? And that requires a sort of a constant corrective to yourself. And I think very often those that write on the Battle of the Atlantic, particularly sort of popular history and so on, there's a sort of a default to the easy sources, to the easy sort of tram lines that we mentioned earlier on, and to the English speaking narrative. So it necessarily kind of tilts always towards a slightly Anglo-centric narrative. And I had to consciously do the opposite. So it's about completeness to me. It's about, how can we really understand that conflict and that theatre if we don't really understand what the opposition were doing and what they experienced at the same time. So it's not about sympathy. It's not about admiration. It's about that. It's about, providing a sort of complete picture to the narrative.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that even somebody like Nicholas Montserrat, who loathed the U-boats, having fought them himself, he wrote The Cruel Sea, even he was adhering to your perspective, and actually that's my perspective as well, about the U-boat arm and their deeds, etc., the empathy bit. I think even he empathised for the what they went through, because he wrote the foreword to a book by the captain of, I hope I've got the submarine name right. So long, I've got the book, but it's a long time since I've looked at it, U-977, which went to South America, ended up in Argentina. And that's a story that fascinates me. And in my own book, I did a chapter on it, because there was the claim that this submarine carried the Führer to Latin America,
which we can we can write off as nonsense here and now,
yes,
can't we?
Totally nonsense. Yeah, I mean, anybody knows anything. I mean, you've learned a great deal, and I know a fair bit myself from my own writing, and I mean, I know a few submariners as well. There's no way that I mean, this strays into the other specialist area of yours. There's no way that a man who was, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, a man who was a drug addict, terrible health, mad, could go on board an old type, was I think a type 7 boat, U-977, all the way to Latin America, when it nearly drove the young men in her crew mad anyway. So yeah, but I've, yeah.
I mean, completely. I mean, sadly, it's almost a necessary digression to sort of, defend the sensible conclusion that Hitler died in the bunker of Berlin at his own hand. But all the evidence we have absolutely points to that. So there is no evidence that he went anywhere near a Type 7 U-boat, and never mind 977, and sailed to Argentina. There's simply no evidence for it. It's pure wishful thinking.
Yeah, and it tends to contradict the reality of what was happening to the U-boat force at the time. You know, that submarine was a knackered old submarine that really shouldn't have been in service, forced to carry on. And then sent to Norway, and then to operate from Norway. And, how would he get out of the bunker to the Baltic to join that
exactly.
submarine to then
exactly.
voyage to Norway?
It's just nonsense. I mean, as I said, it's a great shame that we even have to air this bit of it, honestly. And it annoys me that we always have to, defend the obvious. But there we go.
The common sense, point of view. Yeah. So do you think, if as we wind up this very interesting conversation, do you think, looking at the world we have today, where unknown to many people, bearing in mind Warship Sci-Far looks at modern navies, we do a bit of history, but mainly modern navies and what's going on out there, where we do live in a world where submarines do have an effect. There's not so many of them around, but, depending on which navy you're looking at. But they do have an effect out there at sea, under the sea, doing their business. Do you think there are any lessons from the wolf packs, the Germans trying to wield them to attain victory in World War II? Do you think there are any lessons for would-be totalitarians of today in using submarines to try and get their way? Do you think there's any lessons from World War II and the wolf packs?
I suppose the first thing I would say on that is there's a few points on this. I think the first one is that in essence, what the U-boat war is an early exercise in asymmetric warfare. It's economic warfare, of course. But it's also asymmetric warfare, because it's a relatively, and I stress relatively, cheap weapon being sent out against rather more expensive weapons, whether they be merchantmen or the destroyers that escort them. You know, bear in mind that for the cost of a Bismarck, you could have built 40 Type 7 U-boats, which is one of those great what-ifs, I suppose, of this whole narrative is, you know, had the Germans effectively dispensed with their surface fleet, seen the potential of the U-boat early on and put those valuable resources, and in the German case, very limited resources, into the construction of U-boats, would that have changed the game? And, you know, there are caveats to that, but I think that's an interesting proposition. Certainly would have changed the numbers. But, you know, what this is, to a large extent, is an exercise in asymmetric warfare. And we're seeing the same thing today in Ukraine. I mean, if you look at the way the Ukrainians have effectively, if not wiped out, but at least confined to port what remains of the Russian Black Sea fleet, without actually having a navy, it's quite astonishing. I mean, using drones and naval drones and all sorts of things. Essentially, I see that as a kind of a similarity to the U-boat war. It's an exercise in asymmetric warfare. But I think the main lesson is not necessarily to do with submarines or even naval warfare, but is probably I hope you would agree, Ian, but in terms of where we collectively stand. And where British armed forces stand at this moment in 2025, I would say the lesson is about timely military planning. You know, if you can see war on the horizon, you need to start planning for it, and you need to start investing rather than waiting for it to happen. And this goes back to Dönitz's efforts to get the necessary interest and then the necessary funding, you know, to get the U-boat fleet that he wanted pre-war, which arguably he didn't get until 1942. He gets his, you know, 300 U-boat fleet in middle of 1942, by which time it's too late. You know, if you're facing conflict, you need to you know, get your planning in, get your investment in, start training men, you know, doing all of that stuff. And I think if we're serious about countering Russia at the moment, we need to be doing the same thing. And yet, you know, successive strategic reviews have sort of downgraded the military, downsized it successively. And that, you know, we're not yet in a place that we can afford to be doing that, I fear. So that idea of, you know, timely military planning, strategic investment in those things that are crucial, you know, these are the lessons to me of this period, because the Germans failed to do it, right? They had a possibility of effecting something notable in that strategic battle against the Allies, and I think it was because of that lacking military planning, that lack of investment in the early phase, that they failed to take whatever advantage was there. Add into that, I think a degree of technological fleet-footedness is crucial, and again, the Germans, I think, lacked that. There's you know, maybe after 43, as I said, there's that, you know, switch to different methods of propulsion. The Walter boats, for example, ultimately results in the Type 21, and things like development of snorkels. But for most of the war, they're essentially relying on the Type 7, which is old technology, is sort of repurposed, you know, slightly updated version of what they had at the end of the First World War. So, you know, that degree of technological fleet-footedness, seeing where the enemy is going, what the enemy is doing, and being able to react in good time and with you know, with all the necessary brains and investment in place, that would be another lesson I would suggest is one that we should probably learn. So, you know, I think there are a few top level strategic lessons to learn from this as well, you know, in that respect, because you know, potentially we are facing a hostile world even in 2025, so we have to get up to speed with that.
Yeah, I think you're correct in all of those prognostications, and one thing that the most likely and actually the current and active foe of Britain, the West, NATO, believes in is undersea warfare, whether it's cutting cables or whatever. They're trying to fire missiles from the sea against Ukrainian cities if they can. And submarines are, for better or worse, still part of our world, and they will still be decisive in hopefully there isn't going to be a major war between us and the West and Russia directly, not indirectly via Ukraine. But, you know, you're right. We need to prepare. So hopefully people listen to such such wise words. And anyway, Roger, thanks for coming on. And it was greatly appreciated. Yeah, really good chat.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Warships Pod. And please do check out the January 2026 edition of the magazine, which is out on December the 19th and should make a cracking good Christmas read. Ho, ho, ho. And among the highlights is a feature by James Posbotanis, who was recently on the podcast called Battleships for the 21st Century, about how he sees future battleships shaping up in light of President Trump's call for a return of those amazing vessels. We've also got words and picks on the UK Carrier Strike Group returning home from its global deployment, and a look at whether or not Russia's weapons tests that were recently held are all they seem to be. And that's a good read as well. And unfortunately, we also have our latest look at the state of UK defences, which is something that is in great need of repair. So you get our latest Odin's Eye commentary on that, has some pretty strong words on how things are. And that's about it, I think, for 2025. And thank you very much for listening to all the Warships Pod episodes this year. And have a Merry Christmas, and look forward to providing you with some more fascinating listening into 2026.